Tonight, we are in, and I do not think that we're going to be in here for a really long time, because chapter 17 is a chapter that you're either going to spend 20 minutes in or you're going to spend 20 weeks in. There's really not an in-between here. So what I'm going to do is we're going to start, and I'm going to read from my translation, and we're going to dive right in. But like I said, my policy here with this is, and I'll repeat this probably several times, there is no end to interpretations of what these things are. And honestly, I'm just being straightforward and honest. I have not heard anything that explains things so well that I would die on any of those hills. So if you come tonight and you say, well, I think that the city on seven hills is Jerusalem, I'll say, yep, there are good scholars that say that. If you say, I think it's Rome, I'll say, yep, you can make a great argument. And if you say, I think it's Babylon, I'll say, yep, great arguments can be made. Okay, I think it's Dublin. Yeah, so I haven't heard that one, but I'm sure that there's somebody who's made that argument somewhere. So what's that? I don't know if we can reckon up seven hills, but sure, if we call it ant hills, maybe we are. There are some things that we can say with confidence here. But I am not going to get into the nitty-gritty of pointing at this and that and the other, because frankly, I've heard really good arguments from all of them, and all of the arguments you can kind of poke holes in. And I don't say this to undermine our authority in the Bible, and I don't say this to undermine my belief that the Bible is understandable. I just don't think that we can understand this yet. Either there's more information waiting to be discovered by better scholars than me, or this will make sense in the tribulation, and it doesn't make sense now. I think the best we can do right now is to say these are the options that make the most sense, and when the time comes, it will make perfect sense, and there will be more data that will clarify why we didn't have a good answer. So starting in chapter 17, verse 1, reading from my translation, "And one out of the seven angels, having the seven bowls, came and spoke with me, saying, follow after me, and I will show you the judgment of the great fornicatrix, the one sitting upon many waters, which whom the kings of the earth fornicated, and the ones dwelling upon the earth were made drunk out of the wine of her fornication. And he bore me away into a desert in spirit. And I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was cast about in purple and scarlet and gilded with gold and honored stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and the uncleanness of her fornication. And upon her forehead a name is written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of fornicators and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk out of the blood of the holies and out of the blood of the ones testifying of Jesus. And I marveled, a great marvel, beholding her. And the angel said to me, through what do you marvel? I will show you the mystery of the woman and the beast, the one carrying her, the one having the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast which you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and into destruction depart. And the ones departing upon the earth will marvel, whose name is not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. Seeing the beast that was and is not and will be there. Here is the wisdom having mind. The seven heads are seven mountains, where the woman is seated upon them, and they are seven kings. The five fell, the one is, the other not yet came. And when he shall come, it is necessary for him to remain a few. And the beast which was and is not, and he is eighth, and he is out of the seven, and into destruction he departs. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, such that not yet took a kingdom, but authority like a king they take with the beast for 1 hour. They have this one purpose, and their ability and authority they give to the beast. These will war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, because Lord of lords he is, and King of kings, and the ones with him are called, and called out, and faithful. And he said to me, the waters which you saw where the fornicatrix is seated, They are peoples and crowds and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns which you saw and the beast, these hate the fornicatrix and will make her deserted, and her flesh they will eat, and she will be burned up in fire. For God gave into their hearts to make his purpose and to make one purpose and to give their kingdoms to the beast until the words of God will be finished. And the woman which you saw is the great city having kingship upon the kings of the earth. Okay, now, if that doesn't give you a headache and confuse the heck out of you, I don't know what will. But here's what we can say. There are, before we dive in, and I will hear from you guys your observations, but two observations we want to see. There is an attempt by the angel to explain things. Now, things are not explained to my satisfaction, I don't know about yours, but there is an attempt by the angel to clarify certain pieces of data. And the idea is, in the Bible, that if you can actually figure out from the data given what those explanations are, then you can unlock everything else. It's kind of like building a puzzle. You know, once you get the corners and the outside edge, you can kind of work in from there. That sort of seems to be the idea, because the angel doesn't explain everything. He only explains a couple pieces of important information. Again, even there, the explanation is a bit vague, but maybe we can use that as a basis to move forward. So before we dive into the verse by verse, what observations you guys have, things that stand out to you? Mm-hmm. Verse 9 is... I like how it basically tells you this is hard. It's saying, yep, you're going to need a lot of wisdom to be able to figure this out. And he gives you a piece of information, but it's not at all clear. It doesn't answer every question. So having a mind with wisdom is good, but it's not always easy to have that kind of mind. Other observations? Yeah. Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, at least some of them, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that what the question you're getting at, which is a really good one, is it brings into mind the duration of the woman. Did the woman exist before the tribulation began? And if she did, because you said she's drunk on the blood of the saints. Well, drunkenness takes some time to get out of your system. So she could still be drunk even if she had been drinking the blood of the saints a while before. It's not really the image. The image is that she's continuing to drink the blood of the saints. Graphic though that image may be, but what we don't know is how long the woman's been around. We don't know if she's a new character, or if she's an old character. The fact that she's called Babylon suggests that she's a very old character, that she's been around for a long time. But the fact that this is a new character in the scriptures makes you wonder. So is this a new person? Is this a new system that hasn't shown up yet? Or is this a new way of understanding old information? And I think that's a really live question and an interesting one. At least to me, it's interesting. But the question of that you're asking specifically of who are the holy ones, the ones testifying about Jesus, upon whose blood she's getting drunk? Are they tribulation saints? To my mind, the imagery would suggest that yes, that's what's going on here. But I could make an argument the other way. I wouldn't like that one, but I could make one. Any other observations we have before we start going verse by verse? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, that is an excellent question. Okay, so, that's kind of the heart of this. What you're asking is the heart of the interpretation of this entire passage. So for anybody who's listening at home or listening online, verse 10, the five fell, one is, the other has not yet come. And so the question is, wait, are we still expecting another kingdom to rise up during the tribulation period? That is an excellent question. So is John writing, when he's saying, when the angel is explaining this to him, is he explaining it from the temporal perspective, the timeline of the events happening during the tribulation? Is he talking in the timeline of us living today, those who are living in the church age, or is he talking in the timeline of when John actually received the prophecy? Now you say, well, that's, maybe in your head you're thinking, well, that's an easy answer, and then you hear somebody else disagree with you, and you're like, oh man, how do we draw a different conclusion? We both think it's a simple question. There are lots and lots of interpretations, and all of them, a lot of them depend on where you think this timeline is. If the angel is explaining things from the timeline of saying these things were, they are, and they shall be from when? Because shall be and were and are, those are all time markers, temporal markers that depend on what state of time you're in. If this is from the perspective of sometime in the future during the tribulation, then what your question is, yeah, even after the Antichrist rises, we should be expecting another one of these kings. And that is going to determine how we interpret it. If you're saying this is from the perspective of John writing in back in John's day before Rome has fallen, that's going to affect your interpretation. If this is being written for all of the church age, including now after Rome has fallen, that's also going to affect your interpretation. And so we can see, I brought this just stack of books out here. I decided against trying to reference all of them, but when if you were to go through these, you would find that I think at least some of these guys have different answers on that, on who the kings are, the kings that were, the kings that are, that what they were, now they're not, they will be again. So I think that your question is a really good one, and we'll get to that when we go verse by verse. I'll give you my take on it, but that doesn't mean I'm right. But I just think it's the one that makes the most sense. Right. Yeah, and chapter 17 and 18, at least chapter 17 is interesting because we've again kind of exited the timeline, and we're getting characters introduced to us. So chapter, the seven bowls of wrath, what would that be, chapters 14 and 15, they advance the plot, to use literary terminology, they advance the plot, but now we've kind of paused and we're getting another introduction of characters like we got in chapters 12 and 13, and I think just 12 and 13. And then the plot's going to kind of pick up again in chapter 18, where we're going to see that she's fallen, that Babylon the Great has fallen, and then chapter 19, and basically from then on, we're going to be kind of moving in a linear timeline again, but we've exited the linear timeline again, which, again, like you said, makes it even harder to answer that question because we're adding more wrinkles into this. Any other questions or comments or observations we have before we jump in? All right, well, if you have any, go ahead and just interrupt me, and we'll get to it. So, verse 1, so one of the angels comes, and I chose the word fornicatrix just so I could consistently use the word, that same root word, because prostitutions, whoredoms, you've got, some of those words are pretty old-fashioned-y, although I guess using the trix suffix is also kind of old-timey, but anyways, he's saying, I'm going to show you the judgment. Well, we don't actually get to the judgment here. Instead, what we get is an explanation of who the fornicatrix, who the whore, who the prostitute is. And I also chose fornicatrix because I think that's actually closer to the meaning of the word. It doesn't, we think of prostitution as necessarily involving an exchange of money. That's not necessary in the text. I think it's implied, but it's not necessary. So I wanted to leave room open in case people, you know, wanted to debate that. But what do we know about her? Okay, so I'm going to show you the judgment, and what do we know about her? She sits on many waters, and the kings of the earth have fornicated with her, and the ones dwelling upon the earth have gotten drunk out of the wine of her fornication. Okay, so three things we know about her. She sits upon many waters, she has an impact on the kings of the earth, and then she has an impact on the peoples. So those, incidentally, we will find out are really three ways of saying the same thing. She has worldwide influence on people both high and low. However, she is not universally loved. She has an influence on people, but she is not universally loved. We'll see that a little bit later. Now, we saw the woman sitting upon a scarlet beast. Now, there is a little bit of unclarity whether she, who is sitting on the scarlet beast, if she is full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns, but nobody really interprets it that way. But it is a little bit unclear in the Greek. But she sits upon the woman, she's the woman, she sits upon the beast, and this beast is full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. So who is the beast? We know this. Satan, or you could say Satan. I would not. I would say in John's theology, Satan is referred to as the dragon. So the beast here, I would say, is the Antichrist. And we've had, and look at the description here, the description having a beast, well, beast, Therion, we've seen that consistently being used to refer to the Antichrist and the false prophet. The false prophet has also been called a beast, but he's full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Now, this reminds us of Daniel. Remember back in Daniel, we see these beasts, and there's the beast that is described in a similar way. I'll flip back there just so that we can say we did. So we go back to Daniel, Ezekiel, going forward, Daniel chapter. Trying to find it here. The little horn. Where are you, little horn? Oh. If I knew my book of Daniel a little bit better, I would be able to say this quickly and get you here. But where are you, little horn? I thought it was here at the end. Well, this is a really exciting Bible study, isn't it? Me just sitting here looking through the book of Daniel to find something. I thought it was Daniel. Okay. I wanted to say 8, but I thought that was wrong. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Right there. As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between his eyes came. And then there came another horn, which started out small but grew into power. It grew because of the rebellion. There's some stuff here. There's one that's broken off. There is. Well, anyways, I'll have to look it up and find it for you later. But there's also this description that's used earlier in Revelation to describe the Antichrist, and it's used in a very similar way. But what's that? Can you read it for us? Oh, are you using Treasury of Scripture Knowledge or something? Okay, so 7-Eleven. Oh, no, not really. That's okay. The boastful horn. I was thinking about the horns. There came up a little horn, which came up among them. Three of the first horns were uprooted before it. Yeah, so that it's there in chapter 7. After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, had four heads. I looked, and there was a terrifying and frightening beast. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims. It was different. It had 10 horns. Okay, so it had 10 horns. We've got seven heads here, but we've got the 10 horns. So three of the horns are uprooted. Again, like I said, there's a reference earlier describing the Antichrist this way. But it's fairly clear that this is referring to Antichrist. Seven heads and 10 horns. We're going to get an explanation of this in a little bit, so I'm not going to stop here. But the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet. Okay, so the beast is wearing scarlet. What's the significance of scarlet? Could be royalty. But the problem with saying that it represents royalty is that we also have the word purple here. So it is true that at certain points in history, scarlet was a color of royalty because scarlet was the darkest purple color. It was one of the more rare colors that you could get. However, eventually they figured out how to make purple out of the sea snails, like those. I think they're called myrmex, although myrmex means ant, so I think I'm mispronouncing that. But they could make the purple out of the seashells, that royal purple. So scarlet, a lot of people have associated scarlet with the Roman legions because the Roman legionaries wore a scarlet color. That was kind of their color, is this kind of bright Roman red. So a lot of people have associated that with Rome. Take that for what it's worth. But the woman is wearing purple and scarlet, and she's gilded with gold and onyx stones and pearls. And so what we see is the beast, who's full of blasphemous names, is wearing a militaristic color. The woman is militaristic, but she's also royal, and she's decked in jewels and signs of conspicuous wealth. She has a golden cup in her hand. And what's the cup full of? Abominations, uncleanness, and fornication. So there's this picture of the woman, and we still don't have clarity on who the woman is. We've also, and we've got other questions we're going to ask right here. I'll just pose them to you, and you can think through them as we read the rest of the text. And this has already been brought up before, but is the Antichrist a man, a city, a nation, or a system of government? Is the woman an individual woman, or is she a system, or is she a city? You can ask these same questions. And you think through it as we go through the text. So she's got all these signs of conspicuous wealth, but inside this wealth, we can see that the wealth is rotten, because inside of the cup are abominations and uncleanness and fornication, and upon her head is a name that's written, is written as a mystery. Now, I have said this. I don't think that it means that it says mystery Babylon the Great. I think what the text is saying is, hey, and there was a mystery on her forehead, and then the mystery is, or the riddle is, Babylon the Great, the mother of fornicators and abominations of the earth. So is she mystery Babylon, or is it, hey, let me tell you a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother? So you guys can think through that as well. I tend to think that it's this way. I think that that makes better sense of what we're looking at, and then we only have to deal with maybe one Babylon. I don't know. But I think that what it means is that it's a riddle. We need to sort through who this is. So the woman is Babylon the Great. Now, again, is Babylon the Great a city? Is it a person, or is it a system? Okay, well, let's see what we can find out. Well, I saw the woman. Okay, well, maybe it's a woman because it's described as an individual. I saw the woman drunk from the blood of the saints. Okay, well, so it's probably not an actual woman. If she's getting, or at least she's not only a woman, if she's getting drunk from the blood of the saints and those testifying about Jesus. And again, we have this timeline question. The timeline question has come up before. The angels, but he marvels. So John sees this and he marvels. So look at what's in her cup. So in her cup are abominations, uncleanness, and fornication. But she is getting drunk on the blood of the saints. So somehow, abominations, uncleanness, and fornication are united with the blood of the saints, those who testify about Jesus. So persecution of believers, persecution of holy people, is inextricably linked in John's theology to abomination, uncleanness, and fornication. So does abomination, uncleanness, and fornication mean the same thing? Not necessarily. Maybe what John is saying is, where you find abomination and uncleanness and fornication, you are going to see the persecution of the believers. Interpret it for yourself. I'm not going to tell you how to think. I just think that, to me, that's what makes sense. But John marvels when he sees this. And the angel says, why are you marveling? I will show you the mystery of the woman. He means explain. I'll explain to you the mystery of the woman and the beast, the one carrying her, having the seven heads and the ten horns. So whatever this is, you have the Antichrist. Whatever Antichrist is, whether he's a man, whether he's a city, whether he's a civilization, whether he's a system of government, he is carrying the woman. They are not the same thing. The woman and the Antichrist and the whore Babylon, they're not the same thing. Now, we've got to sort out what they are, but they're not the same thing. And what we can see is the whore Babylon is being carried by the Antichrist. So she is, in biblical imagery, and actually in modern day imagery, if you're riding on something, you're in control of it, but it's more powerful than you. Like, you can ride a horse, the horse is a lot stronger than you. So that's exactly why you ride a horse. You know, you don't get a team of toddlers to pull your wagon, you know, unless you want to not get very far very fast, then you could do that. But you have these animals that are more powerful, something stronger than you that's pulling you, that's something that's carrying you. And so the beast is carrying her. And again, he reiterates, the beast, the one carrying her, having seven heads and ten horns. John wants to remind us of this. The seven heads and ten horns. He's going to keep hammering on this. Why? We don't know. We've seen this illusion before. We know it's Antichrist, but are we ever going to have this explained, or do we have to guess from what we've seen in Daniel? In Daniel, we believe that these heads, at least the horns, are kings, right? They're kings who've been supplanted. What's John going to tell us? I don't know. Let's find out. So the beast which you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and into destruction depart. Okay, so let's pause right there. So you, so she, John is telling us that the beast comes up out of the abyss. Well, we know the beast comes up out of the abyss. We've already seen that the beast comes up out of the abyss. So that's not new information for us. But what is new information is that the beast was, is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss. So that's fascinating. Because now the timeline, again, really matters a lot. If we're going to understand who Antichrist is, we need to know when, what time frame we're looking at. So if the beast, and here's where I think we can sort through this a little bit. He's saying that the beast currently isn't. But we know that the beast is because the beast is carrying the woman. So the time frame of these statements cannot be the time frame of the tribulation. So if we go backwards, so if we look at this and we say, okay, well, or if we look at different places here in this section, and we say, okay, we have to figure out what our time frame is. Our time frame is not the tribulation, because the beast is there, and the angel is saying the beast is not. So the angel is explaining things from another time frame. Now, is the time frame when John was living, or is the time frame when now where we're living now, where every reader of the Bible is reading? Now, you might say, well, Luke, that's really super duper obvious. It's obviously when John is speaking to the angel. I would tend to agree with you. The problem is that we know that the book of Revelation was written not only for John's time frame, but also for the future. And so, I mean, there's a blessing for whoever reads and whoever listens. So are we expected to know, to go backwards into John's shoes and guess? Or are we to take that time frame from where we are now? My answer to that is, again, thinking through this logically, if tribulation saints can't just say, oh, well, it was written to the church for all of time, so it's obviously applicable now. Well, they can't do it because the beast is then. So why should we think that we can do the same thing? If not all of the saints for all of time, since the writing can say that this is the time frame in which this is written, then nobody can. So the only people who can claim that that time frame is the time frame from which this was spoken were the people who are living contemporary with John. So we have to go backwards to where John is. At least in my mind, that's how that works. I know that that's kind of, actually the way I phrased it was probably very confusing, but anyways. So now we see that the beast was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss. Well, we know he's going to come up out of the abyss. The text of Revelation tells us that the beast comes up out of the abyss, and we know when it happens. It happens during the tribulation period. We know that he is not. Well, that's fine. None of that is confusing for us. But what does it mean that the beast was? What does this mean, that the beast was? Well, while you guys noodle on that, I'll throw an option out, because like I said, you can either spend 20 minutes in chapter 17 or you can spend 20 hours. So I'm going to throw something out there. And if you say, Luke, that's dumb, then that's okay. I'm not going to fight with you. It might be dumb. We have a reference to Antichrist. Now, there are lots of people in the Bible who are Antichrists. They're types of Antichrist. Well, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. We've also seen that from John's own literature that anybody who denies that Jesus came in the flesh is Antichrist and that the spirit of Antichrist is in the world. However, if we go back to Daniel, and I would tell you chapter and verse if I knew where it was and I knew what I was talking about, I could point you there. But in Daniel, we have Antiochus Epiphanes is compared to the Antichrist. There are clear connections between that last king in chapter 12 or 13 to the Antichrist. And so what I think John is saying is, hey, the king who attacked Jerusalem, the king who set up the abomination of desolation, there was a king who did that. There's no king like that now, but there will be a king like that in the future. Now, other people say that the beast is the Roman Empire. Now, that would be my favorite pastor, J. Vernon McGee. McGee would point to, he would say it's the Roman Empire, that the beast is the restored Roman Empire. And he would say, the beast was is not, and will be again. And I agree that the Roman Empire was, is not, and will be reconstituted. I think that that's what the 10 toes signify. The problem with Dr. McGee's position is that it forces us to change the timeline that we already know works. Because the Roman Empire existed when John was living. Does that make sense? So you have to accept Dr. McGee's time frame. And by the way, a lot of people take his position that the explanation to this is the Roman Empire. You have to say that John was writing this verse where any Christian in any time in history until the tribulation, after the Roman Empire fell, that would make sense. But that's, to me, that doesn't make sense. That requires us to assume too many things. So some of you guys are old enough to have gone to school and they actually teach stuff. You guys may have heard of Occam's Razor, right? Occam's Razor, you guys familiar with Occam's Razor? William of Occam was a British theologian and philosopher, and he came up with something called the Lex Parsimoniae. The Lex Parsimoniae, another way of calling it is the law of parsimony. The law of being a cheapskate is what it is. And what Occam said was, the best explanation is the explanation that all things being equal is the simplest. So if you can eliminate all the extraneous data and you can say, look, we've got two options and they're fairly equally weighted, there aren't any other impinging arguments. There aren't any other arguments that are weighing in on this. We've got two choices. Whichever argument is the simplest that requires us to make the fewest number of assumptions, that's the best interpretation. So I would apply Occam's Razor to this, and I would say, okay, Dr. McGee, we know that the time frame cannot be the future. It cannot be when John is living because the beast is there. So otherwise, because that statement becomes nonsense. For it to be the Roman Empire, you have to have the time frame be all of the church age before the tribulation, well, the church age doesn't exist in the tribulation, or after the Roman Empire has fallen. That requires more assumptions than simply saying the time frame is from the time frame John was writing from. To me, it's a simpler explanation. Now, you say, okay, Luke, so what is that? Where does that leave us? You're eliminating the Roman Empire, which would make perfect sense because the Roman Empire is something we know did exist, stopped existing, and will exist again. So what do you have left? The best I have is to say that is to point to Antiochus Epiphanes, to point to him as the prototype of the Antichrist and say, that's the prototype. And it was somebody who set up an abomination of desolation before, there, and then his kingdom was destroyed, and then he's going to come again. Do I really like that answer? Not really. I'm not very impressed. If I wrote a paper defending that, I would give myself a C, or maybe an A+. I don't know. It depends on how I felt. But I'm not really happy with that, but that's the best I can do. And frankly, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Sometimes in theology, you just give the best answer you can give. And you know it's not very satisfying. And like I say, I believe that at some point we'll understand this very well, and all of our attempts will seem rather silly, but you never know. But he's going to go and depart, and the ones dwelling upon the earth are going to marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life, the book of life that was written before the foundation of the world, seeing the beast that was and is not and will be there. And so they're saying everybody's going to marvel to see the beast. Everybody's going to marvel. Well, we've already seen that. We've already seen that they're going to marvel at the beast. Well, another interpretation, and again, I don't like this interpretation, is that when they say the beast was, is not, and will be again, is because the beast had this wound in the head and died and resurrected. The problem is that they're saying is not. They're not saying that the beast was, wasn't, and is again. They're saying the beast was, is not, and will be again. So I just don't think that argument holds very good water, or at least not very much of it. So as was pointed out by somebody, verse 9 is kind of a slap in the face for anybody who thinks they have very much wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains. Oh man, Dr. McGee's argument that it's Rome is looking an awful lot better, isn't it? Where the woman is seated upon them, and they are seven kings. The five fell, one is, and the other is not yet come, and when he shall come, it will be necessary for him to remain a few for a little bit. Okay. So the beast has seven heads that are seven mountains. Huh. Okay. Is that Rome? Jerusalem is also built on seven hills. Some people have argued that Moscow was built on seven hills, but I don't think there's a single hill within 1,000 miles of Moscow, but that's neither here nor there, I suppose. Who is this? So what we can say is, if the beast is a man, which I think the New Testament is very clear that the beast is a man, the beast is also a system of government. The beast is also an empire. And I mean, I think Daniel's very clear about this, right? Daniel gives a picture of the multi-metallic image of the seven empires. And that seems really confusing to us. It seems difficult for us. But it's not difficult for people who live in a monarchical world. When you live in a world of monarchy, associating the king with the kingdom is not a bridge too far. It is for us because in our minds, the king, we don't even think in terms of kings. Kings seem foreign to us. Whoever rules a government is completely distinct from the government itself. That's not how ancient people thought. I mean, Louis XIV, who some people say was never clever enough to say, l'état c'est moi, I am the state, whether he was clever or not, I don't know, but that represents the idea of autocrats, that I am the government. The government is embodied in my person. And you see, I mean, we see that right now with Vladimir Putin. Putin has a government of Putin, and people do his bidding. And you might not like that, but that is very much in line with Russian history. The Tsar, or the emperor, was the government, or the empress, if you have Catherine the Great or Anna Pavlovna or whoever. The government is the king. And so for us, we shouldn't think that this is particularly confusing, although it is. It's confusing because we don't think in those modes, but we need to think in the way the Bible does. Anyways, so the empire is the seven heads are seven mountains, and the woman is seated upon them. Oh, okay, wait a second now. So the Antichrist has a government that is a seven-headed government, and the seven-headed government is seven mountains. There are seven mountains. Now, do the mountains actually mean seven mountains? I don't know. That's a good question. But the woman is seated upon them. So whatever the seven heads, whatever the seven mountains are, this is where the woman, it has her seat of power. This is where the woman has her base of operations. And there are, they're not just seven heads, they're not just seven mountains, they're also seven kings. Five fell, one is, the other is not yet come. Okay, so now this is different, right? The beast was, is not, and will be, but the heads on the mountains, five of them are gone. There currently is one, and then there's one yet to come. Okay. There are a laundry list of interpretations of this. I will not go through it. You can do that on your own time because it gets rather heady. And we're not gonna spend our time on that because we would just get lost in the minutia. But whatever it means, it's similar to what we see about the beast. They're trying to give us time frames that are going to help us understand, although I don't find it necessary. But the other not yet came. Okay, so look at that though. The other not yet came. That's a weird grammar. Let me look this up for you, just make sure I've got this exactly right here. Verse 5R. Yeah, and the other not yet came. So could he be saying the other had not yet, hasn't already passed? I don't know, it's weird. It's really weird grammar. And when he shall come, so maybe it is future, it will be necessary for him to remain a little while, and the beast which was and is not, and he is the eighth, and he is out of the seven, and into destruction he depart. Okay, so, So these seven kings, the beast is the eighth. The beast is like the seven. Again, there are a ton of interpretations out there for how to interpret this. What we can say clearly is we're talking about government, we're talking about power, powerful people. And the 10 horns, which you saw, are 10 kings. Okay, so wait a second. So the 7 heads are kings. The 10 horns are also kings. What is going on? Why do we have all these different kings? I don't know. But these kings are different than the other kings. The 7 heads were kings that seem to have passed in some kind of linear time frame. Now, one of the explanations of those kings are the 7 mountains, which frankly I think is the best explanation, and this will make sense, I hope, is that the 7 kings, 5 were, 1 is, 1 is yet to come, are the iterations of world empire. So you have the Antichrist has his kingdom that's coming. And then there was the Roman Empire that was, you know, the legs of steel. You have the feet and toes of bronze. So that's 2. The problem is with Daniel's image, that gives us 3. We've got two other empires to consider. So people have also said, well, we can look at Zechariah, and Zechariah gives us at least 1 more. I don't know. Is it world empires in series? Could be. Is it powerful leaders in series? Could be. I don't know. To me, that seems like a better answer than thinking about some kind of government that has all these kings at the same time, because I think that's what we see here with the horns. Okay, so the horns, but again, we can debate that, and you can interpret that how you want. The 10 horns, which you saw, are 10 kings. They don't have a kingdom yet, but authority, but basically, okay, so I'm going to paraphrase these last couple verses here. These guys have 1 purpose, these last 10 kings. The text tells us they don't exist yet. The mountains exist. The mountains have existed. They currently do exist, and they will exist. There are 7 of them. The Antichrist is among the 7 and is the 8th. And again, that's why a lot of people point to that being the Roman Empire, because the Antichrist will restore the Roman Empire. So he's an 8th king, but he's ruling over 1 of the 7 kingdoms. The problem is that there's not a list of 7 kingdoms anywhere in the Bible that we can make sense of. So do with that what you want. These guys, though, don't have power. They will have power. What's their purpose? Their only purpose is to give their power to the beast. That's the only reason they're given power. God says they will have their power so they can give the power to the beast. And then what are they going to do? They're going to make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb is going to conquer them. And we see that in chapter 19. We'll see that very quickly. Now we get back to the woman, and we're going to continue with the woman in chapter 18. And he says, the waters which you saw where the fornicatrix is seated, they are peoples and crowds and nations and tongues. Okay, well, we've already seen this. We've already seen that she has this power, because that's the very first thing the angel said in explaining who this woman is, right? Because we see, I will show you the judgment of the great fornicatrix, the one sitting upon many waters. Okay, so with whom the kings of the earth fornicated, and the ones dwelling upon the earth were made drunk out of the wine of her fornication. So we've already seen this, but it's extra clarification. So the waters where she's seated, they're peoples, crowds, nations, and tongues. But she's also seated upon the seven mountains, the 7 heads, which are 7 mountains. So is she seated upon the waters, or is she seated upon the mountains? Well, I think that what this is telling us is these things are symbolic. We're not supposed to think that it's actually waters. Now, it might be that this is a maritime city where this is. It might mean that this is a place with mountains. I don't know. But I don't think that's the primary interpretation. What is saying is the woman has power. Where does the woman's power come from? The woman's power comes from government. Whatever else verses 8 through 14 mean, it's talking about government, it's talking about power. Kingdoms, rulers, governments. Whatever we see here in verse 15, it's talking about people, broad groups of people, not necessarily governments, but people, as people. So she's seated upon governments, and she's seated upon people. She rides upon the beast. She has control over the beast, and yet she's less powerful than the beast. So who is she? I don't know. Let's see if we can get any more clarification. The 10 horns which you saw and the beast, these hate the fornicatrix. Okay, so they're not the same thing. There's a temptation to say that the woman is just, that the prostitute is just another form of the beast. No. Is she just another form of world government? No. They hate her. And they will make her deserted, and her flesh they'll eat, and she'll be burned up in fire. For God gave it into their hearts to make this purpose, to make one purpose, to give their kingdoms to the beast until the words of God be finished. And the woman which you saw is the great city having kingship upon the kings of the earth. Okay, so what is the woman? Is the woman a government? Well, she rules over the kings of the earth. But she's seated upon the mountains. She's seated upon the kings. So she rules over the kings, but she draws power from the kings. She sits on the people, but she deludes the people. And the beast and those people hate her. So who is the woman? We've got about 2 minutes left to solve this problem. So who is the woman? I'm asking you guys, what do you think? Who's the woman? Nobody's going to be brave and take a guess on who the woman is? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not going to add anything to what you said. There are these pressures that want to turn people away from God. What is the root of that, though? I'm not asking that as a trick question. I know that probably seems like one, but what is the root of that? Okay. Does anybody else? Anybody else have any thoughts? I know we're getting towards the end of our time here, so I'll say something really quick, a couple things really quick, and then if you guys have more comments or questions, we can address them. But like I said, I know that this has probably felt like drinking out of a fire hose tonight. There's a lot of information, a lot of theories out there. It's a hard chapter, but here's what we can say. And this actually I don't think will help at all. It'll just make it a little more confusing. But the woman which you saw is the great city. Okay, well, if you go back to chapter 11, verse 8, their corpses will be upon the streets of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord is crucified. So is the woman Jerusalem? Could be. Could be. But the problem is that Jerusalem does not rule over the kings of the earth. So we have this issue. Now, you could say, and people could make the argument, well, you know, Jerusalem kind of dominates world politics. Oh, okay, you know what? That's not a great argument. That's not a good one. But what we know about the woman is that governments hate her, but she has power over the people and power over governments. The general interpretation for a very long time is that the woman is false religion. The woman is false religion, and that false religion rules over the kingdoms of the world. That rulers of the world, if they can't harness false religion, they'll try to destroy religion. You know, we saw that with the Soviet Union. We've seen that in Maoist China. We see this all over the world. People either want to co-opt religion. You know, the beasts want to get on the back of the harlot and ride her around. If they can't do that, they're gonna try to eliminate her. They're gonna try to destroy her. The problem is that you cannot eliminate false religion. And I don't want to make a I've gone a little bit over time here, but the problem is that everybody recognizes, every person who has half a brain recognizes that religion is extremely important to people. Religion can bring your country together. That's why Putin is all about the Orthodox Church. I don't think Putin actually believes in the Orthodox Church. I don't think he believes in much of anything. But he recognizes the power of the Orthodox Church in Russia. He recognizes the power that it can give. And so he's going to try to ride the tiger. He's going to get the beast on the back of the harlot. It doesn't work that way, though. And he will learn, and people learn eventually that it doesn't work. In Saudi Arabia, I don't know how many of you guys know much about the history of Saudi Arabia, but the Arabians, the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, took its power because they allied themselves with the Wahhabist Muslims. The Wahhabists or the Wahhabis were extreme. I mean, the most extreme guys. And here was the problem that they ran into. All of their power was derived from their extreme form of Islam, which is already a pretty hardcore religion to begin with. So you can take a guess what the Wahhabis are like. The problem is that once you ride the tiger, you've got to figure out a way to get off. And they didn't know how to get off. Because what happens? If they get off, the source of their power is the Wahhabi imams. So they have to go along with the program. And that's the problem, is eventually, no matter what happens, the whore gets on the top. She eventually rides. You can't ride the tiger. Eventually, the tiger eats you. And that's what world religions have seen. And that's why the beast and the kings hate her. They hate her because they want to be worshipped. They want all that false religion being directed towards them. But human nature, human history has always rejected that. Human history has always directed religion elsewhere. Now, you got to give it to the Kims. The Kims in North Korea have gotten the closest of anybody. But all throughout history, this has been the problem. Kings have tried to unify religion into their own person, but they're never able to really do it, at least not for very long. And anyways, who's the woman? Is she a woman? Is she a city? Is she a system, a religious system? Is she the Roman Catholic Church? Is she the Lutherans? I don't know. I would say the best answer we have is the woman is, broadly speaking, false religion. Who is the beast? Is the beast a man? I think so. Is the beast a kingdom? Probably. Is the beast a system of government? Seems like it. But that is world government in opposition to God. So what we see two characters addressed here. We see the whore and the beast, the harlot and the beast, the fornicatrix and the beast. We see them in that order. And what's going to happen in chapters 18 and 19? Chapter 18, the harlot is destroyed. Chapter 19, the beast is destroyed. What are these systems? Government opposed to God, religion opposed to God, government opposed to God. False religion, false government. God is going to destroy both of them. Now, you could have said, Luke, you could have just said that at the beginning and saved us a whole lot of time, but, you know, hey, I got to exercise my voice for tomorrow. So, anyways, you guys have any questions? I would say that the false religion encompasses Muslims. A lot of people say that they want one, they think that this has to be one world government, or one world religion, I'm sorry. I tend to agree with you that it won't happen, but something's going to get close to it, and I don't know how it's going to happen. A lot of people have said it will be Islam, that if it's one world religion, it'll be like some form of Jesus exalting Islam, where the Antichrist will be the reincarnation of Jesus, that Jesus will be the 12th Imam. In fact, actually, I'll say this. If you guys have not read up on it, do yourself a favor. Read up on the 12th Imam. I-M-A-M, Imam, the 12th Imam. The 12th Imam is, it's not in the Quran. Actually, it might be in the Quran somewhere, but it's not generally Quranic, but it is the belief of Persia is Iran or the Shia, Sunnis or Shia? I think they're Shia. Yeah, in Iran, they're the Shia Muslims. I think within Sufi or Shia, and my knowledge of Islam is very, very weak, they have this belief that they have like their own version of the Book of Revelation. And their version of it is talking about the 12th Imam. And so do yourself a favor, check out the 12th Imam. It is amazing the parallels between what they believe about the 12th Imam and what we teach about the Antichrist. The 12th Imam is going to go out and he's going to persecute the Jews and the Christians, and he's going to set up a one-world government. It's like, I believe in your 12th Imam. I just don't think he's a good dude, you know? So anyways, check that out. But yeah, I-M-A-M, Imam, 12th, like the ordinal number after 11th. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's, yeah, I-M-A-M, the 12th Imam. I've never heard those as the seven continents. Yeah. I'm trying to think if Antarctica counts. He's going to arm the penguins and everybody's going to have to do it. No, I would tend to say that's not the answer, just because North America, South America, Australia, and Antarctica were unknown to them at that time. And part of that is kind of an arbitrary division that we create, because we say there are seven continents, but why are Europe and Asia different? And is India its own continent? I'm not trying to crap on your idea. Yeah. Yeah. You know what you should do is you should take a lot of time, research it, write a paper, and then you'll be able to publish a book, and you'll be on all the talk shows, and you can start making prophecies and making lots of money. I think that's the plan. I think that's the best way is to make a whole lot of money is to write a book on something that has no answer. And so dispensationalism, there are generally two major ways that people understand how God interacts with people in history. So it's not historical theology. Historical theology is how theology has been done through history. Covenant theology or dispensationalism, that's the theology of history. And so covenant theology basically says that the best way to understand how God has interacted with humans is through the covenants that God has created with certain people. So when we look at the before the fall, there was a covenant that God had with humanity. And that covenant was as long as humanity didn't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, mankind would experience no death and there would be no bad. There'd be nothing bad that we would experience. It's a tacit covenant, but it's, you know. Yeah. So then you have the Adamic covenant, which would be, that's an interesting way to call it a covenant, but the Adamic covenant, which is reigns from Adam until Noah, where mankind does not eat any flesh, but there is this idea that man is beholden to God, and there are certain sacrifices that humanity will bring. And then there's the Noahic covenant from Noah all the way on to Abraham, and then there's the Abrahamic covenant, and then from the Abrahamic covenant on, excuse me, to Christ. Within that, there's also the Davidic covenant and the covenant with Zadok, and there are other covenants, but broadly speaking, God's major covenant is from Abraham, and then there's the Mosaic covenant as well. And the Mosaic covenant also, which is encompassed by the Abrahamic, but the Mosaic covenant is significant. And then that continues until the New Covenant, depending on which covenant theology system you're following. And then they would say from the New Covenant on, that is the dominating covenant. That is how we understand how God interacts with the world is through his covenants. Now, dispensationalism was a system of thought that came out in the, I think some people claim that there were some people who were doing it in the 17th century, and there are some hints that people had ideas of it before. But really, as a formal system, it really didn't begin until guys like Darby. So you have guys like Darby and Scofield and these others, and these are the dispensationalists. And they believe that the primary way to understand how God interacts with humanity in history is through the dispensations. Now, the dispensation is just the English translation of the Greek word oikonomia, or economy. So it's an economy. It's a way that God deals with people. Now, there are lots of different forms of this. There are at least three major forms of dispensationalism. There are a lot of different forms of covenant theology. But broadly speaking, dispensationalism can encompass covenant theology. So dispensationalists can say, yeah, I believe that God works in history by different forms of government. That's really what it says, is God has different forms of government for different periods of time. At least that's one way to understand it. Covenant theologians say, well, God institutes government through his covenants. So it's really a question of which way you're looking at the problem. Well, dispensationalists can encompass the covenants. The covenants can't really do the same thing. So dispensationalism can explain the covenants, but covenant theology has to basically dismiss dispensations as saying they're not really a thing. It does. It gets very complicated. Now, where the rubber meets the road is in dispensationalism, you really cannot be a dispensationalist and believe that God is finished with Israel. You cannot believe that the church has replaced Israel. In covenant theology, you can. Now, not everyone does, but for a lot of people, that's really considered the marker. If you believe that the church has replaced Israel, it's also called supersessionism is another name for that. That's the $5 word version. But supersessionism is this idea that the church has replaced Israel. It's also called replacement theology. that's for a lot of people a dividing marker. If people say, yes, the church has, they would say, well, you'll fit in with the covenant theologians. And if you say, no, the church has, and then they'll say, oh, you'll fit in with the dispensationalists. It's not that simple, but as a general rule, that's kind of how people fall out.
Yeah, and so that would be the question that, covenant theologians would ask. And a lot of dependent, and I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush, but a lot of covenant theologians would say, all the promises, and they would point to a scripture verse, they would say, all the promises of God are yes and amen in Christ. And they would say, through Jesus, the church can take every promise in the Old Testament and apply it to the church through Christ, and all of them are ours. Dispensationalists would say, no, some of the promises are ours, because some of them are very specifically given to, like, we can't take circumcision. Like, I mean, you can circumcise your children, but that doesn't mean that you have the covenant of circumcision. Now, you could say we have a spiritual form of it, but a dispensationalist would say, even if we have a spiritual form of circumcision, the circumcision of the heart, that doesn't negate the fact that Israel was given the covenant of circumcision and that that doesn't go away. And so a lot of it is a lot of times the two positions are extremely close. Sometimes they're very divergent, and it's very complicated kind of sorting everything out. So. Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, Ironsides is a very respected, very good scholar. I mean, it's if you're interested, I've got resources. If you're interested, stick to what you got. Okay. So, but all right, guys. God bless you.